Coffee Kyle was carrying Preston, which struck me as immensely funny. Sloane was holding Taylor, who was already in his life jacket, and AJ was swinging between Emerson and Mark. Kimmy ran onto the dock. When she reached us, she stopped, her hands on her knees, panting.
"Phew," she said. "I was afraid I was going to miss the boat."
"Me too," Jack said. To everyone else, I'm sure it seemed like nothing. But to me, his words felt heavy, laced with longing, and what's more, anticipation.
"I sure am glad you didn't," Hal said. "How would you have ever gotten all the way over to Starlight?"
We all turned our heads and laughed. It was a laughably short distance. With all the preparation, the food, the tents, the lights, the massive amount of planning crammed into a very short window, all of us gathering on this huge boat as though we were off on a grand voyage, we had forgotten this was a journey we could have taken via kayak, or had we been strong swimmers, no vessel at all.
"More importantly," Mom said, "who would have brought my pot brownies?"
That set everyone off again. It was a good start. I was afraid this would feel like a funeral, somber and heavy, but it didn't. It was a party for sure. Emerson had done wonders with Mom's hair. She looked lovely in her knit pantsuit. I smiled, but then it hit me what we were here for. Her literal going-away party. I was going to wake up one morning, probably soon enough that I could count the days on my fingers and toes, and she was going to be gone. I would never again see her face, never hear her laughter, never call her on the phone to ask her opinion. No, it hadn't been perfect. I would never fully understand her decision when Carter died. And sometimes she wasn't as touchy-feely a mother as I really wanted her to be. Still, although she may not always have been what I wanted, I had to consider that she had always, always been what I needed. I felt the lump in my throat growing, and I knew I wouldn't be able to control it much longer. As everyone chattered around me like this was another ordinary day on the island, I turned and walked as quickly as I could without arousing suspicion into the luxurious interior of the boat and into Jack's room. I closed the door behind me and sat on the end of his unmade bed, the same unmade bed I had not only picked the linens for, but also made love to him in. Then I started to cry. I knew I had to get it over with. I would never get through this day without at least a few tears. When I heard footsteps and a hand on the doorknob, I tried to gather myself and wiped my eyes. But when I saw Jack's face coming through the door, I lost it again. As he came closer, I expected him to wrap me in a hug, rub my back, tell me it would be okay, or anything soothing that would calm my nerves and dry my tears. But he didn't do any of that. Instead, he put his hands on my cheeks and kissed me so passionately that I truly felt like I was living that night by the lighthouse all over again. Only this time, the only thing making me feel giddy and free was Jack. We looked at each other for a long moment after that kiss, neither of us daring to speak.
"You have 6 months," he said. 6 months to get your shit together, to get over your excuses and your fears, whatever they are."
He'd never spoken to me so firmly or so intensely.
"Let's face it, Ainsley, your life is a disaster zone. No one, and I mean no one, in his right mind would want to get mixed up with you. But I do. I want you."
He paused.
"I won't say it again. 6 months from today, a for sale sign will go up in my yard. I will leave. I will wish you well and be on my way. I am too old to play these games."
He turned and, with his hand on the doorknob, repeated, "6 months."
I knew I'd never make it that long.
I wholeheartedly believe seeing your husband become a father can only make you love him more. That had certainly been the case with Carter. Bringing Caroline into our world changed him completely, and I was in love with how in love Carter was with baby Caroline. If seeing Carter with his daughter made me love him more, if watching him change diapers and get up for middle-of-the-night feedings and take her off on errands so I could get some sleep had compounded my love for Carter, then seeing her eyes change into Jack's, watching the way her lips curled when she smiled, and the color of her hair darken into his made it impossible for me to forget about him. That was perhaps the unexpected consequence. It shouldn't have been unexpected, of course. I should have prepared myself for that, closed the wind shutters, battened the hatches. But I hadn't known yet how spending those weeks with Jack and giving birth to his baby would cause a deep longing for what we could have had to take permanent residence inside my chest and remove the light from my eyes. I never talked to Jack, never called him, never visited or wrote a letter. But it was no consolation. No salve existed for the pain of being apart from him. Yet I knew instinctively that the anguish I felt over losing him was nothing compared to what it would be if I left Carter and chose Jack, like he had asked. So the night Carter had come to me and said, "I think we should start trying again," I held myself back, but I wanted to run upstairs, tie my shoes, and hop the first plane to Atlanta. I was like an addict who had spent years without a fix, still craving it with every ounce of her being. I was going to give in to my primal need for it again. In the back of my mind, I knew it would only make things worse and prolong this profound loss I felt in every cell. Time would never erase the memory of Jack and what we shared, would never allow me to get past what I felt for him. And so, seeing him again, asking him this unaskable favor for a second time, might be, as my father would say, a temporary solution to a permanent problem. If I wanted another baby, which I did, desperately, this was how I would get one. I knew already without hashing it out with Carter again. At the time, it didn't seem odd to me that he was so against people delving into our personal and financial lives. He had always been private. He had convinced me that if we let an adoption agency dig around, they might find out that Caroline wasn't really his. I could never let that happen. I realize now that was just a cover. He wasn't worried about them finding out about Caroline. He was worried about me discovering what a disaster he had made of our finances. As soon as he died, and I found out about the debt, it all made perfect sense. I should have been angry at him for leaving me out in the cold, for not telling me the truth. But I knew even then that, in his own way, he was trying to protect me. Plus, there was no sense in holding grudges, especially against a dead man. Much like that rainy night in Peachtree Bluff when I boarded a plane into a great, wide, unknown expanse of which I could never have predicted the consequences, that morning I kissed my husband, stroked my sleeping baby's forehead, and left for what I'd told Carter was a girl's trip. He didn't delve deeper. He knew better. My stomach was in knots the entire flight, a mix of anxiety and unadulterated, nearly maddening excitement. What if he was involved with someone else? What if he wouldn't agree to this again? Soon after I landed, I was swigging Pepto-Bismol in the back of the cab on the way to his house. It felt riskier this time, showing up unannounced. By the time I had arrived at Jack's small but charming Buckhead home, admiring the ivy that grew over the trellis around the front door, I was so worked up I had almost convinced myself to go back home. but the need for his lips to be on mine felt stronger than my need to make the safe choice. It was a Tuesday evening, so I figured he would be home. Only when I knocked, there was no answer. I knew immediately I should have called. What if he was away on a trip? What if, even worse, he came home with a woman? I had to be prepared for that scenario, didn't I? I had no claim to him whatsoever, except for, I had to consider, his heart. A hot flash of jealousy ran through me at the thought that someone else might have his heart now, and he hadn't given me a second thought. I walked around the side of the house and into the backyard, the high heels I had laboriously picked sinking into the grass. I leaned to the left to compensate for the weight of the heavy duffel bag on my right shoulder. I smelled the grill before I saw him. I stood quietly at the edge of the patio, on the small pathway surrounded by mature bushes that were probably 8 feet tall. I watched the way his mouth curved as he sipped his beer. The way that vein on his forearm I had always loved running my finger down became more pronounced as he flipped the steak. The way his eyes crinkled when he smiled to himself. I took a step forward, into the safety of the bushes, and, as if I had triggered some silent alarm that only he could hear, Jack turned. Our eyes met. I smiled. I expected him to run to me and scoop me up in his arms, or at least walk casually toward me in his completely charming and irresistible way. But he didn't either. Instead, he sat down in a black wrought-iron chair behind him and put his head in his hands. I had the sinking feeling that I had made a huge mistake, that this was going to be nothing like what I had envisioned, and I had ruined Jack's life. I had caused him the same pain and anguish I had caused myself. I dropped my duffel on the edge of the patio, and even in his distress, even though I wasn't sure it was the right thing, I went to him. I had to at least try to ease the pain I had caused. Jack's head was still in his hands, and as I kneeled to look at him, I realized he was crying. I knew then I shouldn't have come. But he looked up at me, put his hands on my cheeks, and said, "Oh, thank God." I realized his weren't tears of distress. They were tears of relief. All those months that Jack had been the insistent tick-tock in the back of my mind, the beat so persistent and rhythmic that you incorporated into your life, learned to coexist with it, that the things he had said, the way he smelled, the feel of his lips on mine, had been running through my mind on an endless loop. He had felt the same. And now I was here. In that way, I had felt like I couldn't live one more moment without a fix. He couldn't either. He didn't say any of that, of course, but those three words told me more than any long, convoluted monologue could have, because those three words perfectly expressed what I had felt all that time. He pulled me onto his lap and kissed me, not with passion, but with ferocity, as though he could make us one. Make it so I could never leave again. In that moment, as I felt myself ripping the T-shirt over his head, I thought that was what I wanted too. To be with him. To never leave. To be one with him like I had dreamed of since we were children. Never before and never since have I completely lost myself like that. I've never felt as though I had disappeared into another person, and that time and space and direction no longer existed. It was only Jack and me in that private backyard paradise that, in the coming months, would become a place I would lie in to feel the sun on my skin, a place where I would pretend for hours on end that I was going to bring Caroline and never leave, a place where I would experience emotions so complicated, so convoluted, and so intense that I was certain I would completely lose my mind. But then, it was just Jack and me and the love we'd had since we were teenagers in his Boston whaler. Just Jack and me, in the knowledge that sometimes love really isn't enough. Just Jack and me. And a horribly charred steak. And the realization that what we had done wasn't making a baby. It was reigniting a flame, an old one, one too intense, perhaps, for either of us to stand. We wanted that fire. We never wanted it to go out. And lost in Jack that night, I never could have predicted how irreparably we, like that steak, would burn.
25. True South. Sloan. March 28th, 2016. Dear Sloan, you can't imagine how much the thought of you keeps me going. How much knowing I have you to come home to makes me know everything is going to be okay. Now that I'm the Sarge, everything feels different. I have to be the strong one now, Sloan. I have to be the brave and fearless leader, the one they look to when they are feeling low. It's hard for me to stay strong sometimes, but I look up at the stars at night and I picture you there in Georgia, in the land of peaches and pecans and peanuts, of all the things that are right with the world. And I know one thing for sure. You are my true south. No matter where I am, no matter how far away, my heart's compass will always, always lead me back to you. All my love, Adam. When I heard the voices downstairs begin to get louder, I finally roused myself to get ready for the day. For Grammy's day. Her last day at Starlight Island. We think and talk a lot about firsts, but we never really take the time to savor our lasts. Not enough time, anyway. Maybe it's because they break our hearts so much. I don't actually remember, for example, the last time I nursed either of my babies. I likely won't remember the last time either of them sits on my lap or kisses me on the lips. Maybe that's just as well, because it would be too hard. In the savoring, we would never be able to let it go. And letting go is the essence of life, the thing that keeps us moving forward. That's what made this morning particularly difficult, realizing it was, definitively, the very last time we would spend the day with our sharp, beautiful grandmother over at the island where we had spent countless hours with her in childhood. That last made me think about the last time I had Skyped with Adam. I'd been upset with him, angry even, something I seldom was. I was an expert at putting on my brave army wife face, but on the inside I was a wreck most of the time. The thing I respected about Adam most, his dedication to his country, freedom, and his family, was also the thing that bothered me most. Because in my heart of hearts I just wanted him to come home, to me, to the boys. He could get a regular job or go back to school, but I never said that. Well, not until that day. Through my tears, I had said, Adam, please, make this your last tour. Just come home already. The look on his face had pained me. I know this is hard on you, babe, he had said, to which I retorted, No, Adam. Hard is an hour-long spin class. This is unthinkable. I knew the exact difference between the two, in fact, because Caroline had made me go to an hour-long spin class the day before. Even through the not always wonderful Skype reception, I had seen Adam was hurt. I didn't want to hurt him, especially not when he was living through something so unimaginably difficult. I wanted to make things easier for him and be that strength he needed, and 99% of the time I was. But not that night. I can't stand this, Adam. The kids are getting older. They're going to start to remember when you aren't here for months on end. I know your country means a lot to you, and so do your men, but you need to choose us. I knew he wanted to argue with me then because he thought fighting for freedom and safety was choosing us. That was how he saw it. Sometimes that was how I saw it too, but not that night. He didn't bother to argue with me. He simply sighed and said,
"Okay, Sloane, I'll think about it. We can talk about it when I get home."
That had been our last conversation. Oh, I hated that. I always said that last conversations didn't matter when you truly knew how much you meant to each other, but now I understood. It was awful to think that the last time you spoke to someone, especially someone you loved so much, was in anger. But there was little I could do about that today. All I could do was make sure I didn't have another regret, that I gave my grandmother a proper goodbye, the kind of goodbye that would make me look back with a smile, not with sadness that I hadn't done the right thing. It was that idea that finally got me out of bed. Sometimes no matter how you're feeling, how sad you are, how hurt, the only option is to get up and keep going. I'd heard it all my life. Now I was living it. An hour later, Caroline was leading the charge to the boat, and all I could think about was how Mark and Emerson were so in love, giggling and cuddling. It was like stepping back in time, as if I were looking at the head cheerleader and star center from Peachtree Bluff High, the kids they had been when they fell in love the first time. Nothing had changed at all. They didn't even look older. I hated them a little. "Okay, Grammy," I said to my grandmother, who was sandwiched between Hal and James. "How do you think these crazy characters are planning to get you in here?"
"Oh, seems pretty simple to me,"
Kyle interjected as he slid his arm under Grammy's knees and she wrapped her arms around his neck. I saw her wince when he lifted her, but instead of complaining, in true Grammy style, she said, a deep southern accent dripping off her every word,
"I've always depended on the kindness of a stranger."
Caroline, Emerson, and I laughed, and she looked back at us, putting her hand up to stop Kyle from walking.
"Take note, girls. That accent is the secret to southern charm."
"Why, whatever do you mean, Grammy?"
Caroline asked in what was one of the best southern accents I had ever heard, real or otherwise.
"Come on, Caroline,"
Emerson said in her regular voice, which was a little southern.
"You're a New Yorker." "And yet," Caroline said, still channeling her inner Scarlet, "I do the accent better than any of you."
We all laughed again, and Caroline, Emerson, and I crowded around Grammy, who was lounging in a pile of pillows at the dining table banquette.
"This really is the way to ride, girls," she said.
I noticed Jack coming out of the cabin, and when, a few minutes later, Mom followed, Emerson, Caroline, and I all shot each other looks. "That looks pretty suspicious," I whispered first.
"We all see what's happening here," Emerson said. "We aren't 12.
"Maybe you girls should talk to her about it," Grammy said.
"Maybe you should talk to her about it," Caroline said. "She'll listen to you."
"She never has before,"
Grammy exhaled, and we all laughed. Then she added,
"But now I'm dying, so she has to."
Just like that, our laughter turned to tears, as quickly as a summer rain shower bursting from a stray dark cloud.
"Oh, girls," Grammy said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You have to remember I'm very, very high right now."
We erupted into watery giggles. As I looked over to Starlight Island, I thought about the fairy stones Caroline had found for us there,
how we had kept them in our pockets, how Grandpop said they were a gift to us to keep us safe. We had lost them on that same island where she had found them, and we were devastated, to say the least. And Grandpop had said to us,
"The fairies gave your stones to someone else. Someone who needed them more than you did."
I had found that comforting, but it still hurt to remember what we had lost. They were more than a toy. They were a gift given to us by the land, by the sea, by this place we got to visit every summer that we loved so much. I looked up at Caroline, whose eyes were on me. It didn't matter now. It had been so long ago, but I still wondered who that man was that Mom was arguing with that day on the beach when we left the stones.
"What are y'all laughing about?" Mom asked.
"Oh, nothing," I said, looking around. Amidst this strange, sort of sad, sort of funny, sort of happy day, I had to pause to realize how incredibly lucky my mother was. These people were here today because of her. They were here in the morning on a gorgeous summer day when they could be doing anything else, because they were devoted to her and wanted to give her an amazing memory with her dying mother. I walked inside the boat where Taylor and AJ were examining how one of the hatches opened and closed, and pulled them both onto my lap, wiggly creatures that they were. I knew this wouldn't be the last time I held them, but I breathed them in anyway. I squeezed them to me, savored their warmth, memorized how good it felt to hold my children. It was a fleeting moment. AJ, with his Superman cape tied around his neck over his life jacket, wriggled free and, yelling, "I'll save you, Gransley," was back on the stern in a flash. I kissed Taylor and set him free, too. The beach looked truly beautiful. Caroline had a trellis set up about triple the size you would see in someone's wedding, and it had yellow and white striped paper lanterns. Yellow was Grammy's favorite color, hanging from it. The table underneath the tent was overflowing with flowers, and Kimmy was fussing over the trays of delicacies I'm certain she had been up all night creating. I hoped Grammy would be able to eat a bite or two. I put my arm around my sister.
"You're really something, you know that?"
She grinned at me, popping a cherry tomato into her mouth.
"I am, aren't I?"
I noticed how Kyle fussed over Grammy, how he helped Kimmy, how he talked intently to Jack. Anything to keep from watching the Mark and Emerson love fest taking place in the corner.
"It's like they never broke up," Caroline said.
"Wait," Mom said. "Maybe that's what's happening. Maybe it's really 2008 again." We all laughed.
"They look pretty together, though,"
Caroline said. Mark was super cute. Not scorchingly hot like Kyle, but cute. And Emerson looked happy. That was all that mattered.
"All I've heard from her," I said, "is how she doesn't have time to worry about relationships because all she can think about is her career."
"Well, she doesn't look worried," Caroline said. Emerson took a bite of a ham biscuit Mark was feeding her. She didn't look worried at all. I walked over to the table, poured us each a glass of champagne, handed one to Grammy, one to Caroline, one to Mom, and said, "Here's to love."
"Here's to love,"
Grammy said. Tears caught in my throat with the realization that, in no time at all, this beautiful woman, this head of our household, who had done nothing but love us, would be gone. Grammy had said earlier that the accent was the secret to Southern charm, but she was wrong. This putting on a brave face, carrying on, helping others, being kind and humble and giving, believing with all your heart that the world could be a better place and that maybe you could make it that way, that was Southern charm.
Looking around at these women who all embodied those qualities so well, I had to think that maybe Grammy was wrong. Maybe it wasn't a secret at all.
26. Safe Passage. Ansley.
I know I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget the way my mother smiled with all the people who loved her most surrounding her. I will never forget the way Jack kissed me, how it was different from any other time I'd ever been kissed. I felt very clearly in that moment that the tables had turned in some way. He had the upper hand, and he was serious this time. This was my last chance, and though I wasn't sure if it was the right decision, I knew it was a chance I needed to take. The best part of the day was when a man on a paddleboard floated up to Starlight, and as I was about to ask Mom, "Who is that?" she practically yelled, "Scott!" I let him hug her first, but I couldn't wait to get my hands on my little brother. In true Scott fashion, he had perfectly chiseled abs and was shockingly tan for early June. But when you spend so much time south of the equator, that is bound to happen.
"Mom," Scott said breathlessly, her face in his hands, "you look as beautiful as ever." I could tell he was lying. The tears in his eyes gave him away. He knew she was dying. It was written all over his face. He squeezed me, lifted me up in the air, kissed my cheek, and said, "How you doing there, big sis?" Then he pulled away, squinted, and said, "Wait, is that Jack? Like from high school?"
"It sure is," Mom said. "He's standing in for my sorry eldest son. I rather like him. I think I'll keep him, actually."
We all laughed, but Scott and I exchanged glances. I had spoken with John earlier that morning, and he promised he would get here to see Mom early next week. As I looked over at her, so happy but so small in the tall chair made of hammock material that Caroline had covered in flowers, I couldn't help but wonder if early next week would be too late.
Scott squeezed Sloane next. "How are you?"
She shrugged. "Breathing."
Scott nodded gravely. "Listen," he said, turning toward all of us. "You know I've spent a decent amount of time reporting in Iraq over the past few years. I have a lot of contacts there. I know how to get deals done, and I think I can get the cash to do it."
He paused.
"I'm going over there to look for him."
Sloane cocked her head to the side.
"Wait, I'm sorry, what?"
"Adam, I'm going to go look for him," Scott repeated. My heart thudded in my chest. We already had one family member missing in Iraq. Yes, I had to come to terms with the fact that Scott was always going to be on some adventure or another. And if I spent my whole life worrying about his safety, it wasn't going to be much of a life. But going to Egypt when there's a travel advisory is one thing. Going into a war zone as a hated American journalist was quite another.
"Scott," I said, not sure what to say next.
Caroline and Emerson were wide-eyed. Mom said, "I'm proud of you, son. I really am."
"How would you even begin to look for him?" Sloane asked.
Scott waved his hand as if this were a minor detail. "I think going over there and trying is better than sitting here waiting." He paused. "I mean, not for you. You've got kids to take care of. Nobody's counting on me."
"Me," I wanted to scream. "I'm counting on you."
But I stayed quiet. This was a bridge to cross another day.
Mark interrupted, saying to Mom, "I got you a little something for your birthday."
Mom put her hand to her mouth in surprise, and then ripped the wrapping paper with a frail and shaking hand to reveal a beautiful box of Easter egg-colored macarons from La Durée.
They were Mom's favorite things in the world.
"How did you get these?" she gasped, motioning for him.
She kissed Mark on the cheek as he said, "It doesn't matter how I got them. It only matters that you get to have them on your birthday."
Mom pulled out her favorite green pistachio macaron.
She offered the box half-heartedly to us, but we all knew better than to accept. This was Mom's treat. It was her day.
I could tell she was getting tired, so I leaned down to her. "Are you ready?" I asked. It nearly broke me in half when the tears came to her eyes. "Goodbye, beautiful beach," she said. "You have given us so much life here."
Then she swallowed and said, "Don't take it for granted, Ansley. Come here whenever you get the chance. Feel the sand underneath your feet. Run your fingers along the water. Don't let this life pass you by."
Then she looked up at me and smiled and patted my hand. "I'm ready, darling."
Holding Scott's hand, Mom dozed in between Scott and me on the ride back to the dock. As she drifted off, and the girls were in the salon finishing the rest of the champagne with Jack, Kimmy, Kyle, Mark, and Hal, I practically hissed at Scott.
"You are not going to Iraq."
He shrugged. "Ansley, her husband is over there, probably trapped in some god-awful cave."
"So what are you going to do about it?" I asked. "Write him to safety? Pen his journey to freedom?"
"Maybe," Scott said. "Maybe I will. But all I've been able to do since I heard the news is think about that pitiful girl sitting over here worried to death and her poor husband. I know people. I might be able to help, and I'm going to try."
I shook my head. "Great. That's just great. So now I'll have a husband killed by terrorists, a son-in-law killed by terrorists, and a brother killed by terrorists."
He grinned at me. "On the bright side, you don't have too many different things to hate. Simply saying you hate terrorists pretty much covers it." I couldn't help but smile. He reached over our tiny mother and squeezed my shoulder. "I won't die, sis. I didn't die in that avalanche on Mont Blanc. I didn't die from that green tree viper bite on Machu Picchu. I didn't die those nights we played Edward 40 Hands in college. I'm gonna be all right." I smirked. "So what about our brother?"
"Anse," he said, "you've got to let it go. You can only control you, and John can only control John."
It was an inopportune time for our mother to wake up, but with her eyes still closed, she said,
"I love all of you unconditionally. If he doesn't come here to tell me goodbye, I've made my peace with that."
I believed her because I had no other choice.
I whispered, "But you love me the best, right, Mom?"
I winked at Scott. He leaned down, too, and said, "Mom, just tell her she's your favorite daughter. That will appease her. Don't break her heart by admitting I'm your favorite child."
We smiled at each other, and though her eyes were closed, our mother smiled, too.
This was a game we had played with her nearly our entire lives, a game we would likely never play again. It was so small, so simple, so insignificant. But even the insignificant becomes terribly important when you know it's going to be over. I squeezed Scott's hand, and I realized it didn't matter now who won or lost. Didn't matter who Mom's favorite was. This was a pain Scott and I would share, a pain only we could truly understand. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. I would worry about that when she was gone. For now, I was going to savor every second we had left.
27. The Lifetime Movie Version. Sloane. August 5th, 2011.
Dear Sloane, I know you said you weren't upset earlier on the phone, but I can't express to you how much I wish you had gotten pregnant before I left. I'm sorry I couldn't give you the baby we want so badly. But when I get home, we will try again, and this time it will work. This time we will get everything we have ever wanted. I already have you, Sloane. This baby will just be the icing on the cake. Wonder if the icing will be pink or blue. All my love, Adam.
It was only a few months between the time Adam and I had started trying for a baby and the time he was deployed again. It wasn't enough time for us to be worried or for him to be suspicious. It was very unlike me, this big lie. I was never one who could keep a big secret, but I had managed to keep this one quite splendidly. It wasn't until Adam was gone that the gravity of what I was doing really set in, that the level to which I was compromising my marriage hit me. My adoring husband, who trusted me implicitly, believed that when he was making love to me, we were trying to make a baby. Only I knew he was alone in that. It was that letter that really did it for me. All I could think was, here is my husband halfway around the world, fighting for my freedom, and I have betrayed him in the worst possible way. I thought about writing him a letter, explaining to him my position and that I was sorry. I would try to make him understand my reasons for what I had done, explain that I wanted to make him happy, but I did not want children under any circumstances. But I knew this wasn't something I could write. I couldn't hide behind a letter. I had to tell him in person. So for the 6 months he was gone, I wrote to him under the pretense that I, too, couldn't wait to have a baby. I reasoned that if, God forbid, something happened to him, he should get to be happy just a little longer. I never told anyone what I had done, how I had lied to my husband, how the secret I kept from him had nearly cost me my marriage and the love of my life. Now, sitting on my mom's screened-in back porch with my two sisters, that seemed a world away. I could hardly remember a time when I didn't want children. Couldn't imagine I had ever envisioned my life without these little people who, while frustrating at times, made my world go around. Earlier that night, for the first time in weeks, I hadn't rushed through putting my children to bed. I didn't feel the urge to get back in my pajamas as quickly as possible to get the day over with. Maybe that was the gift in this whole thing. I remembered this was the only life I was going to get, and one day I was going to be gone and wouldn't get to spend time with my boys. I read to them, snuggled into my side until Taylor fell asleep and AJ could barely keep his eyes open. Then I sang their favorite songs until AJ drifted off as well. I stared at them, trying to remember them as babies, trying to memorize them now, as though I could tuck this perfect moment somewhere deep inside myself and save it, like Adam's letters, for a time when I really needed it. The screen door squealed open, breaking me out of my thoughts, and as it slammed shut again, Scott appeared, a beer in his hand.
"Nothing will make you want to drink, quite like your mother dying."
I didn't want it to, but my mouth opened and words flew out. "Try having your husband missing in action." Scott grimaced. "Scott," I said, "it was nice what you said earlier, but you aren't really going to Iraq, are you?"
"Oh, I assure you I am," he said, taking a seat and crossing one leg over the other. "I'll book a flight as soon as..."
He trailed off, and I swallowed away the tears for what that "as soon as" meant.
"So what will you do when you get there?"
Emerson asked, leaning toward him intently. I had a feeling she was picturing this all unfolding on the big screen and what her part would be. Probably me. because the terrified wife in the Lifetime movie version would most certainly be a tall, blonde, thin 26-year-old.
Civilians tend to know a lot, Scott said, and I have a lot of friends in Iraq now. I'll do a little digging into where the boys were when they crashed, and I'll do what I do best, ask questions.
Does that really work? Caroline asked. I sighed. Sorry, she said. I'm sorry, of course it works. She turned to Scott. This sounds like a great idea, uncle of ours. I have the utmost faith in you.
Thank you, he said.
I think it's the craziest damn idea I've ever heard, I said. And if you're killed by a landmine or left to die in a prison somewhere, I will blame myself forever.
He shook his head. No, you won't. I'm doing this for completely selfish reasons.
How is this possibly selfish? Emerson asked.
Because if I go over there, find them, and report on the whole thing, no doubt I'll win a Pulitzer.
He winked at me.
For real, though, he said. I'm going of my own accord, for my own reasons. Do I want to save Adam and get my niece her family back? Absolutely. But if it all goes awry, that's on me, not you. I know what it's like.
It was borderline stupid that knowing Scott was going made me feel better. I mean, my husband was God only knows where in that dusty desert land of caves and rock. It wasn't like my uncle, who was trained in journalism, fly fishing, and very little else, was going to track down my husband and bring him home safely to me if the world's finest military hadn't managed it yet. But after months of sleepless nights, my teeth ground down, my eyes bagged, my shoulders slumped, the color drained from my face, I needed something, anything, to hold on to. Scott loved me. And he loved Adam, and sometimes that's as good a reason as any to believe everything is going to be okay. Scott squeezed my knee and said,
Okay, girls. Uncle Scott is going to bed.
Yes, Caroline said firmly. You're going to need your strength. She paused. Grammy and Mom are on the front porch. Let's go out there with them.
Emerson nodded.
Perfect. My wine glass has been empty for like a half hour. Grammy was snuggled on the couch in a nest of pillows with blankets all around her. Mom was right beside her as though if she got close enough, she could breathe for her, keep her here. There were so many things I could say to Grammy in that moment, but I only squeezed her tightly and said, I love you so much. I hope you had the best day.
I love you too, sweet girl, she said. This was the best day of my life.
Hey, Mom exclaimed. What about the day I was born?
Grammy laughed.
The best normal day where no one was born or married.
The door opened and Emerson flopped dramatically on the couch while Caroline spread out on Mom's new outdoor chaise. It seemed fitting she would get the best seat. Queen Caroline, past, present, and future. In that moment, with all the women I loved most in the world crowded around me, it didn't feel like anything was out of the ordinary. It didn't feel like anyone was dying. It didn't feel like life was about to change in ways we couldn't even imagine. And so, when I look back on my life, that moment, just Grammy, Mom, my sisters and me, sharing stories and laughing until we couldn't breathe, is one I want to remember. When I think of Grammy now, when I imagine her in heaven, she is having a night just like that.
28. Prodigal Son, Ansley. When the girls finally went to sleep that night, I knew Mom had to have been beyond exhausted. I tried to take her to bed, but she refused. "Darling," she asked instead, "could I trouble you for a cup of tea?" "It's no trouble at all, Mom," I said, walking back into the house. A few minutes later, I was about to open the door when I heard Jack's voice on the porch. I stopped, my back pressed against the wall inside. I could just make out Jack saying, "I honestly don't even know when I would ask her, if we will get to that place. But I can't bear the thought of marrying Ansley without your blessing." Mom laughed. "Oh, darling, I can't think of anything much finer than that." I couldn't see her, but I could imagine the way her eyebrow rose as she said, "It would be lovely to have your family back together again." I heard Jack choke. My heart was racing. Oh, my Lord, she knew. My mother knew. "I'm not sure what you mean," Jack recovered. "Oh, Jack," Mom said. "Anyone who has ever seen you and Caroline side by side would know you possess a shocking likeness." There was silence, and then I barely heard Jack say, "I thought that was only in my mind." I held Mom's hot cup to my chest and gasped quietly. She knew, and he had corroborated. I was about to burst out the door to confront Jack, but then he said, "You have to understand. Ansley needed something, and I gave it to her." He paused. "I would do anything for that woman, then, now, and forever. I would move heaven and earth for her." Mom cut him off. "You would keep a secret that would eat away at your soul for nearly 35 years. It took my breath away to hear her say that, and I felt the tears gathering in my eyes. After everything we had been through, everything we had lost, everything we had shared, Jack had still been there for me. And I couldn't help but think that maybe it was high time I shared some of myself with him. "To be honest," Jack said, "I wish I could let her go." "But true love lasts a lifetime," Mom said. "Exactly." She said quietly, "And now, I'm ready to be reunited with mine." As I opened the door, I smiled brightly at Jack. "Oh, hi," I said casually, not wanting them to know I had overheard. "What are you doing here?" "Just saying goodnight to your mom," he said. He stood, leaned over, and kissed Mom on the cheek. She patted his arm. "You're a darling boy," she said. "You've always been my favorite." "Mom," I scolded. She was nonplussed. "I'm sorry," she said. "I love Jack. So what?" I shook my head, and Jack laughed as he wrapped one arm around my shoulder and kissed my head. "I'm here if you need me," he whispered before walking off the porch. "Of course I need you," I wanted to yell after him, but I didn't. Not for the first time and not for the last, I watched Jack walk away, his silhouette disappearing down the street. I handed Mom her tea and sat down beside her. "I've said it before, and I'll say it again. You really should marry him." "For heaven's sake, Mother, we aren't even dating." Her eyelids grew heavy, and for a moment I thought she was about to fall asleep. But then I realized she was glaring at me. "I know true love when I see it, Ansley, and it doesn't take too much to make a man forget you are his. Men who will love you like that, sacrifice for you, do anything to make you happy, don't come along all that often. I suggest you beg for his forgiveness before he runs off with a 40-year-old who isn't moody and menopausal." I couldn't help but laugh,
Moody and menopausal. Thanks, Mom. Glad to know what you think of me.
I think you will both feel much better once you tell the girls he's Caroline and Sloane's father.
I nearly spit out the water in my mouth.
Jack tried to deny it, Mom continued, but the man is a terrible liar. That is a wonderful quality in a husband.
If that day ever comes, I will say yes, Mom.
She smiled and nodded, realizing I had overheard their conversation. She always knew the right thing to say. Always. Which is why I would never understand. I had needed her advice, her encouragement, and her fortitude for all those months when it felt like I was suffocating, when it felt like Carter wasn't the only one who had died. Now she was dying, and I didn't have much time. So I took a deep breath. Mom, I said, all these years, I've never brought it up, but I can't let you go without asking. Why didn't you help me when Carter died? She smiled calmly at me. Look around you, darling. Look at the life you have, the life you built. She leaned in closer to me. You, not me, not Daddy, you. I began to understand then that we were different parents. But her methods weren't selfish, just how she showed love. You built this life for yourself, honey. Your store, your town, your friends. You raised those girls, and you fought through your pain, and you came out the other side. You survived. Hell, you thrived. And you did it all on your own. Mom sighed and said, I know it came between us. But Ansley, if you had come home and wallowed in your self-pity and your fear, that's all you ever would have done. Look at you, my girl. You are magnificent. That day she told me I couldn't come home was the scariest day of my life. I had this jewel of a house my grandmother had left for me, but that was it. I had no job, no plan, no idea where the world would take me. But I had to wake up every day. I had to get out of bed and take care of my girls. I thought of Sloane, and I wondered if maybe I had done the wrong thing. Maybe my mother was the one who had known how to handle tragedy and adversity. Maybe I should have taken a page from her book. But there was no right way to parent. We all just have to do our best. She smiled at me sleepily, and I knew she was about to drift off. That's a good girl, she said. Can I take you to bed, Mom? I whispered. No, darling. I need to be here with the sea and the stars and the sky. Then she fell asleep, breathing heavily, no doubt dreaming of the near-perfect day she'd had on the beach. I put more pillows around her so she wouldn't fall. I sat by her for quite some time, and I'll admit it, I prayed. I was still ambivalent at best about God's presence. But I prayed for her safe passage into another world, where she could be with Daddy and check on Carter, where she could be happy and out of pain. I didn't know that was the last conversation I would ever have with my mother. But it was perfect. It wouldn't have felt right for our last conversation to have been dripping in I love yous and you're the best thing that ever happened to me's. No, she told me what she thought, gave it to me straight, and left me with something to chew on. She was making sure I would be okay after she was gone. It meant more than anything else I could have imagined. She should have had weeks longer to live.
Hospice wasn't even coming until the next day. But that night, my mother closed her eyes and didn't open them again. None of us was with her, but she wouldn't have wanted us there. In fact, I'm quite sure that if we had kept vigil over her bedside,